There's no, you can't arrive what the federal evidence says. You have to explain. You can use experience, but you have to explain how you got from here to there. There's nothing but taking his word for it, plucking numbers out of air. And if Judge Lindberg wasn't free to say this is too speculative, then what judge could exclude speculative testimony? In terms of other markets, Judge Easterbrook, I asked him, I said, did you look at, are there other markets you could have looked at? He said, it's not relevant. I asked him that question 3 or 4 times. They're not relevant. He didn't say there were no other markets. He just said, they're not relevant because Puerto Rico is unique. That was his answer. That's why there was, I didn't use the word market regression analysis of other markets. He said, did you look at other markets? No, they're not relevant.
Well, let me ask you this in a different way. Did you have an expert who attempted to analyze the way in which this kind of work is properly done?
No.
Well, one of the problems, this is a problem in every Daubert case. The lawyers are effectively asking the judges to play social scientist or sometimes physical scientist. The basis for criticizing this expert's view is not, as you've just said, the view of some better expert about how this kind of work is done. It's lawyers' critique about how the expert behaved. And maybe the lawyer's critique is a good one, or maybe it's a bad one. But generally, I'm inclined to think that social science disputes should be handled by social science methods rather than by having lawyers say, well, I don't like the way this work was done. Whether it's good or bad social science probably can be determined more accurately using the methods of social science.
Judge, you would be having me prove a negative. What we said...
No, not proving a negative. Just introducing evidence about how these kinds of issues are handled by genuine, qualified social scientists. If you look at the economic or sociological or whatever literature, whoever studies these kinds of issues, let's see how they study it.
Then you're putting the burden of proof on me. You're putting
Look, putting evidence in about how social science works does not affect who bears the risk of non-persuasion. That's the burden of proof. It is often the case that litigants are required to produce evidence. Just think of how discrimination cases are handled. There's a prima facie case, then the employer shows something. The burden of persuasion is always on the plaintiff. But it's very difficult to resolve social science issues with no evidence, I mean literally no evidence from either side in this case, about how social scientists grapple with problems like this.
May I judge just to... They came up with 2 experts first. Then, after the cutoff date, they asked for continuance. And then they submitted this expert as their 3rd expert report. And I didn't get it till, and it was dated September 30th. The discovery cutoff, I believe, was October 19th. We deposed him shortly before discovery cutoff. They slipped this expert in at the last minute, practically, after getting giving us 2, almost like a decoy. And then this one gets thrown in after they get an extension of the expert deadline, and there's a number of things we don't even know what they're saying. Whether they're saying their market opportunity was permanently lost or only temporarily lost. They were saying at one point that we caused them to lose 1,500 actual subscribers, and there was an issue whether they were talking about old subscribers versus future subscribers. And then on the eve of the cutoff, they got an extension. Judge Lindberg let them put this expert in. And then to say to me that I should then go out and have gotten some kind of regression analysis or figured out what their actual projections are, I thought the whole case was barred by the Illinois New Business Rule. Because this is the classic case that wasn't based on any historical experience. This was based on their hopes of new and unprecedented numbers of subscribers that they never got before. Our theory from day one was they were never going to be able to prove this because it was too speculative. Just in terms of a lot of the stuff about the box was put forward, obviously, to arouse the court's indignation on the box. I'd just like to Many, as Judge Lindbergh found, this was a complex system. It was a disputed issue of fact, what the causation of some of these issues are, whether it was in the head-end equipment or whether it was in the signal or whether it was caused by our box. But here's the basic facts that they can't dispute. The box couldn't have been so bad. They were successfully converted their subscriber base within a year. And even after they had a choice, the so-called multicast, the simultaneous transmission of signals, they continued to buy our box. If the box was so bad, why did they continue buying it? Only after we discovered, and they were sanctioned for this, late, that they continued to buy our boxes. And just to forestall, you may ask me, how could we not know they were buying our boxes? Because they were buying them from Bell South. Zenith sold the boxes to Bell South. Bell South, we sold them to WHTV. Only afterwards, then they said, oh, the multicast didn't work. And it was only 1 month prior to that revelation that they had filed a motion in the district court asking us to deem, they had served a request to admit, and they were dissatisfied with our answer, and they asked the judge to require us to deem that the multicast worked. And on the appellate record...
Counsel, just go back a minute. You're saying after the commencement of this litigation, they were still buying from Bell South your boxes?
That's correct. In 2002 and 2003, they continued to buy the box. The multicast was in place December 2001. And up until 2003, as late as May 2003, they were trying to get Judge Lindbergh to compel us to deem admitted that the multicast was in operation and working. And that's on their appendix, page 1473. A month later, when we discovered that they were continuing to buy boxes, then they said, oh, the multicast doesn't work.
Wasn't their response, though, that they would have to replace the entire set? They couldn't integrate some other system, other box into the system?
That was the point of... No. That was their explanation for why, prior to the multicast, they were hostage, quote, because they'd have to change everybody out. The point of the multicast was to transmit simultaneously two different streams that would both simultaneously allow the operation of the Zenith box and the boxes of someone else. And that was done in December 2001. As late as May 2003, they were telling the judge to force us to admit that it was in operation and working. Again, that's 1473 of their appendix. And then, a month later, or thereabouts, when we discovered that they still bought our boxes, they completely flip-flopped and said, oh, no, the multicast didn't work. And that's why we had to keep buying the boxes. One final point, Your Honor, and that is counsel mentioned to you the management projections. By his own words, he told you that they were compiled from a variety of different sources from talking to other people. That was an alternative basis that Judge Lindbergh didn't rule on, but we argued below that that kind of opinion is hearsay and would not have been admissible. Thank you for your consideration.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Benjamin. Mr. Doctorman.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Doctorman. I represent General Instrument and Motorola. General Instrument was a latecomer to this appeal, just as it was a latecomer below. The court is familiar with the record. If there is any appeal as to General Instrument and Motorola here, it is very, very narrow. You heard WHTV identify its claim that it did not abandon an appeal with respect to General Instrument and Motorola. But the only mention of General Instrument and Motorola in its brief, its opening brief, is at page 5, where it says, the district court entered judgment in favor of Zenith on WHTV's fraud claim and in favor of Motorola and General Instrument on WHTV's promissory estoppel claims. And that's it. It's virtually impossible to tell what General Instrument and Motorola were to defend here. And in fact, the issue below in front of Judge Lindbergh was equally obscure. Boiled down to the promissory estoppel issue, however, it is what would WHTV have done differently had General Instrument acted differently? And the answer was nothing. And there is absolutely nothing in the record before Judge Lindbergh to suggest a basis for promissory estoppel. It also is noteworthy that in January, 4 months after we were added to the case, Judge Lindbergh granted our motion to dismiss on the ground that we were not successors to Zenith on any contract claims. Those orders have not been appealed. So the only claims would be estoppel claims, and the only one that has been mentioned is promissory estoppel. It's also hard to see how they do not appeal the finding against them on equitable estoppel, but yet find reliance or suggest reliance on promissory estoppel. With respect to Zenith, we bought assets. It's just as simple as that. Pages 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 of our brief lay out the chronology. When you buy assets, you do not assume all of the liabilities, and that issue has not really been changed. The only thing Zenith appeals as to General Instrument is whether they should have been allowed to amend their third cross-claim against us at the last minute to suggest a brand-new physical theory against us, and Judge Lindbergh said no, that's within his discretion. Unless the court has any questions, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doctorman. Mr. Starkman, anything further?
To suggest that Judge Lindbergh had a theory other than testing in mind when he refused to let Dr. Shapiro testify is belied by his very opinion. In the written opinion, Judge Lindbergh told WHTV what his
Let's put testing to one side. I want to ask you the same question that I finally managed to formulate for Mr. Benjamin. Is there anything in this record that would enable us to figure out how these kinds of analyses are conducted by acknowledged specialists in this field?
There is nothing in this record that would answer that question.
Right. I hope you heard my concern. I'm very concerned about lawyers' talk one way or the other about how social scientists do their work, but it looks like there isn't any, or at least not much help in this record to figure out how social scientists do their work.
I think that's correct on this record, but the adversary process suggests that if you want to challenge the methodology of an expert, you ought to have your own expert to do that. Otherwise, it falls within the intellectual rigor ordinarily used by experts. One final fact, we purchased additional sets while this case was on from Bell South because Zenith didn't make them anymore, and the people that Motorola told us would fix them couldn't fix them, so we had nowhere to go to replace sets that were defective in the field except through Bell South.
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. Starkman, and thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.